Welcome to the Plant Grow REIT podcast.
Welcome back to Plant Grow REIT. I'm David Bishop, the superannuation manager at Aintree Group. And today I'm joined by Frank Lasparta, who is an SMSF specialist auditor and advisor from Seamless SMSF. Welcome, Frank.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for having me.
No worries. So today we're diving into something that every SMSF trustee needs to deal with each year, and that's the audit process.
The dreaded audit process, hey? Oh, no, we've got an auditor here. What's he going to tell us?
It sounds like a bad joke, an accountant and an auditor walk into a bar. So we know the word audit can, you know, it's not the most exciting word, makes people's eyes glaze over a little bit. Hopefully we can provide some useful tips to SMSF trustees out there on what to look out for and how to make the process less painful, maybe even enjoyable.
I reckon we can do that. I reckon. We're going to try and have some takeaways here. We're going to try and make everyone's life easier. So they don't. It's not that they'll look forward to the audit, but it won't be as dreaded.
That's good. Let's do it. So start with the basics. What's some of the most common reasons that you see would cause a SMSF audit to raise queries on your end?
Okay, so I guess in terms of queries can come from a number of different sources, and most of the time it's lack of documentation. Just remember, when you have an auditor reviewing an SMSF, what they will be looking for is they're looking for documents, and they're looking to see if there's been any problems, i.e. breaches. Now, the breaches don't actually happen that often. It's more that the queries are arising because there are missing documents. And so my question would be, is what's causing those missing documents? What is causing those documents to not be provided to your auditor? Because if you think of the process from start to finish, you've got the trustee who holds the SMSF, who's gathering all the documents, then they provide it to the accounting firm, you, mm-hmm. and then you have to prepare the accounts and then send it to me. So usually what is causing these queries, these lack of documentation to rise, is a break in the process of some sort. Is it with the trustees where they don't have a method of getting you the documents? Do they even know what documents to give you? What's your process like in terms of what you provide the auditor? It's that process from start to finish that causes the queries to arise.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, the trustees won't even be aware of the queries because the accounting firm, you, hasn't even really got a process on what to provide us. Mm-hmm. So I think really the queries arise from a lack of process. That's the biggest thing that we see.
Yeah. So from our end, we try every year to send early on in the financial year to send a exhaustive information request out to all our clients, detailing to the we try and make it specific as possible to that client, and not just ask for, you know, bank statements or portfolio reports. We try and outline, okay, we need this Commonwealth Bank statement from X to Y dates. We need this ComSec or NAB trade account statement from blah, blah, blah to blah, blah, blah. And I think that does help alleviate a lot of the queries, I would imagine.
That's right. And I think it's like anything in life. What you put in, you get out. The more work you put into something, the easier life gets on the back end of mm-hmm. it. So
it's an investment, really.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So if I'm an accounting firm and I want to reduce my audit queries, and if I'm a trustee and I really want to make sure that my accountant has everything so I'm not getting bombarded with queries from the accountant and the auditor and maybe the financial advisor, I would be following that checklist to a T, and I would be seeking a proactive firm like Aintree Group that actually do put time into making sure that you have all the documentation, you know what to provide, you've got examples of what a portfolio report looks like, and you've even got a method on how to provide the documents to the firm. I remember back in the day when you would do an audit, it would come in a shoebox or a binder with 1,000 pages.
Whereas some manila folders.
That's right. Yeah. Now we've got this thing called the internet, the cloud we hear. Mm-hmm. And so there's ways to really optimize your documentation process and sort documents a bit neater. So then even if you've given your accountant all the documents, they've got a way of actually sorting through it in an orderly fashion. So I think those things are just the basics are the things you need to get right first.
Yep. And I always say that whenever a super fund trustee, you know, maybe complains about, oh, why do I need to provide this or what X, whatever, I always try and say that, listen, at the end of the day, the auditors, they're asking for these documents in some way to protect the trustees, because we hear about all these scams all the time. I think there was one recently where they were fabricating portfolio reports and, you know, and not providing them to the auditor or something like that. And it's just about, you know, at the end of the day, we're just trying to make sure that the ducks are in order. Is that the phrase? The ducks are in a line or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Ducks in a row. I think that's the one. And to make sure that, yeah, you're compliant, the ATO is not going to come knocking. And yeah,
that's right.
Super funds, you know, ticking along nicely.
Exactly. And I think once you've then got your basics in order, you can then start to get a bit fancy and do some more, I guess, niche things to help bring things in line and make things easier. One, I think, which is very beneficial is embracing technology. Again, back in the day, you'd have to provide every ounce of documentation to your accounting firm client. But now you can set up data feeds for your mm-hmm. bank accounts, for shares. There's ways of having investment providers directly mail your accountant the investment reports. Mm-hmm. Financial statements are all online now. So there's ways where trustees can embrace technology, embrace data feeds, and that is going to decrease the burden at their end to then have to provide these onerous documents to you.
Yeah.
Now, it is important to understand that not all data feeds are equal. Depending on where the data feed comes from will dictate whether as an auditor we are able to rely on that data feed as independent evidence.
Can you provide an example? A situation I've come across before is a trustee saying, well, here's my share site, you know, report that I've prepared. Can we not just use this
yep.
as evidence?
So when you look at a data feed, essentially for the data feed to be relied upon from an audit sense, it's got to be, well, you're testing me here, ASAE 3402 compliant. And essentially what that means is that data feed is independently tested and it can be relied upon as independent evidence. So in other words, it gets audited, it goes through testing mechanisms, the feed is reviewed regularly. So that data feed, the controlling body that is responsible for that feed, has some reporting and quality assurance framework to confirm that that feed can be relied upon. So a really, probably the gold standard of data feed is Class Super. Their bank statement data feeds, their share data feeds, they can be relied upon because it meets that standard. They pay that money to go through that audit process, meet the requirements. And so as an auditor, if we are given that data feed from a Class Super software, bang, we can rely on it. Something like a different provider that may not have those audit requirements, that can't be relied upon individually. So you can use the data feed as a secondary source to help confirm balances, to help reassure you of what is happening, but it technically, by the rules, it can't be individually relied upon.
Yep, great.
That's how I would meet it. But I guess whether or not the data feed can be relied upon or not, the key is to embrace the technology and embrace software, because it's still going to make your accountant's job easier with reconciling, with mm-hmm. with, you know, generating income, all these things that your accountant used to have to do manually. The data feeds and software and technology will help. Even signing documents, like since, you know, the last, what, 5-7 years where we've got electronic mm-hmm. signing, how much easier is that now?
Yeah, it's great. I remember when I first started doing the accounting work for super funds, I would have to log on to share registries for every investment and download dividend statements,
yeah.
holding statements. It would take hours to reconcile a simple fund with, you know, 15 holdings that paid quarterly dividends. It would take forever. Whereas nowadays, like you said, all the feeds set up, the system knows, okay, you hold X amount of shares, you're entitled to 15 cents per share. Therefore, if your investments reconcile, Income reconciles.
That's right. It's
straightforward.
And in an industry where, you know, costs are going up, there's fee pressure from everyone, I think the data feeds just make it easier for your accountant to at least, like, keep costs and the process a bit more efficient too. It saves the trustees time doing certain functions. So I think it's just a win for everyone.
I agree. Right. So hypothetically, the worst case scenario, something goes wrong.
Yep.
What are the outcomes or the different types of outcomes of an SMSF audit? Can you talk about the qualifications, the different types of breaches, and I guess the consequences as a result of those?
Okay. So when you are conducting an audit, and this is for any audit, take out self-managed super funds, but this is just audits in general. Within an audit, there is two checks, essentially a compliance check and a financial check. Financial check is referred to as part A, and a compliance check is referred to as part B. So what ordinarily people will think when it comes to audit and problems is the part B, the compliance part, but they forget part A. So first thing is within part A, they are items where it is financially reporting. So whether the financials have a misstatement on them, or maybe there's a risk to the accounts, they're the part A items that could arise. Now, they're not necessarily a breach, but it is something that the auditor will note on their report. The most common one that you might see is if the SMSF has a loan to someone and it's unsecured. There is a risk there that the trustees, the fund, the entity, might not recover its money. So as an auditor, you would highlight that risk with a part A qualification to the trustees, simply where we note on the audit report, hey, Mr. and Mrs. Trustee, did you know that this loan is unsecured? There is a risk there, and this is an SMSF investment. So you might just want to revise that and just have a look and just make sure that this is what you want to invest in.
And that's going back to my comment earlier about part of the audit is looking after the trustees and raising issues that could result in financial detriment to the trustees. They may not be aware that loan is unsecured.
That's exactly right.
Or they may not be aware of the risks involved in the nature of that type of investment, cryptocurrency or whatever.
Yes, that's right.
And you're simply bringing that to the forefront of their mind through the audit, and they may make changes as a result of that.
That's right. And when you have when an auditor highlights either a part A financial or part B compliance breach, we'll call it, that changes the audit report from unqualified to qualified. So we've got a qualified opinion that we're providing to the trustees. And where you've got a part A or part B qualification, it does get highlighted on the income tax return that the accounting firm will lodge with the ATO. Now, the ATO, where you've got a part A qualification, they're not made aware of what that part A qualification is, because for the most part, it's irrelevant. It's really just something to highlight to the ATO, hey, there was a part A qualification. So that's fine. We then get to part B. Now, part B compliance is essentially where the fund has done the wrong thing. Let's use a couple of examples. The fund has loaned money to one of the members. The fund has borrowed money that isn't is not one of the exemptions, for example, a limited recourse borrowing arrangement. The fund has placed a charge over one of its assets. The fund hasn't complied with the investment strategy rules. The fund has withdrawn money early before meeting preservation age. They're some of the part B compliance breaches. Now, we have guidelines, and essentially we go through those guidelines, and if one of the guidelines are met, that breach is reported to the ATO through an audit qualification, and we lodge a contravention report to the ATO. Essentially, like we mentioned earlier, when the accounting firm lodges a tax return, the ATO actually aren't made aware of what that part B qualification is or part A. Mm-hmm. But what we know is if there's a part B qualification and it meets a certain criteria, then that the details of that breach need to be reported to the ATO by the auditor, us. But if it's not severe, if it's not a large consequential breach, then what will happen is it will be noted in a management letter to the trustees, and then essentially, in essence, the trustees have 1 year to rectify that breach. They are aware of it, and then hopefully by next year's audit, that's all resolved. But if that breach is then still there, then one of our guidelines says, okay, now you need to report it to the ATO. So the easiest example is one of the guidelines, two of them, the most common ones, are is the breach amount worth more than 5% of the fund's assets, or is the breach amount higher than $30,000? They're one of the two. So for example, if I've got a loan to member of $10,000, it's less than 5%, it's less than 30 grand, but you can't do it, it's going to get noted in a management letter. And then if it's not rectified before the next year, we then have to lodge it with the ATO. And so when the contravention is lodged with the ATO, that's what will spark penalties for the trustees. We know that there are administrative penalties. One penalty unit's around about $11,000 or $12,000. It can vary up to, I think, 10 penalty units. It depends on the type of breach, but essentially they're very, very large penalties that could be fined to the trustees. Education directions, where in other words, the trustees need to be educated on how to be a trustee and do the right thing. There's other things like a forcible undertaking, where a breach might get reported and then the ATO will force the trustees to resolve that breach in a certain way.
So they follow up on that as well.
That's right. Yep. And so what I would say to trustees is that if you think you're doing the wrong thing, if you're not sure on what to do, if you're just in a bit of a, oh, I don't know if this is right or not, check with your accounting firm. They'll check with the auditor, they'll give you the advice, and everything will work fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just go off on a whim and don't get things checked and just have a guess, well, that's when problems can arise. Something as simple as buying a property. What name do I put on the purchase contract?
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you seen that become a problem? Yep. You know, it seems simple, but if you don't put the right names on the contract, that's going to be a problem. So just going through the process and checking everything off before you, I guess, action anything.
Yeah. I guess an area that a lot of our clients deal in and also happens to be an area that causes lots of audit issues is the related party nature of some of those transactions.
Yes.
Like you said, we have multiple clients who they purchase a property in their fund and they take out a limited recourse borrowing arrangement with themselves as a related party lender. Now, again, nothing wrong with that at surface level, but then you get to the detail of who's there on the contract, charging the mortgage over the property, setting up the bare trust causes.
That's right. Yeah. And I think one thing that I would say, if you want some examples of where funds can go wrong with related parties, here's your little snippet and your soundbite for the episode. If you're an SMSF and you're dealing with a related party, a related entity of any sort, have your documents in line. Don't think that you are above the law, and because you think it's above board and you think it's at market rates, that the auditor is just going to be able to use a magic wand and make sure that it's market rates. Actually put the time in to do the steps that you would complete with any other unrelated party.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if you're an SMSF and you're borrowing from a related entity, have a loan agreement in place, have a bare trust, make sure that you are following the correct borrowing terms. If you're leasing a property to a related party, get an appraisal so that you know how much rent to charge. Make sure you actually have documented a lease agreement, because the amount of funds that we will audit where there's a related party and the trustees haven't even sought a rental appraisal because they know what market rates is. Well, mm-hmm. Look, unfortunately, as an auditor, we're trying to look at this from a third party lens. You need to be able to show us how you've determined that rate. Objective and supportive data is what we rely upon. So if you don't have that with the decisions that you have made with that related party interaction, that's going to raise audit queries. And guess who's going to wear the brunt of it? Your accounting firm client, because the accounting firm, your tax agent, because they're the ones dealing with the auditor. They're the ones trying to resolve these queries, but it could all be resolved if the related party, the super fund, just got the documents in line.
I think the worst thing you can do is to execute the transaction and then ask how to fix it. I think you have to be proactive. Say, I'm thinking about doing this. What can I do to make the process compliant? And what documents do I need?
That's right.
By the auditor.
And particularly when it does come to property in general, that is a bit of a hot topic with the ATO at the moment. You know, property valuations, lease agreements, loan agreements, these are things that are right at the forefront of auditors and the ATO. So I would encourage you that if you do have any related party dealings, make sure you've got an appraisal, make sure you've got a lease agreement, make sure you're able to use objective and supportive data to value the property each year, and just go through that process. Trustee, accounting firm, go through that process and really just look at everything before it's being sent to the auditor. And that will set the 5 minutes you spend getting the documents all in order, making sure they're all there, reviewing the agreements, take that time, then send the fund to the auditor. And your audit query is almost half if you've got property.
Yep. So I guess following on from that topic, are there any other types of specific investments or transactions that attract more scrutiny from auditors?
I guess taking away property, the other one that did become wildly popular a few years ago was the cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. That sort of went from 0 to 100 really quick because obviously we've got this new type of investment. No one's ever looked at it.
They were missing the boat.
Yeah, that's right. And so all of a sudden every super fund started investing in crypto. And when you really break it down, it's actually not too dissimilar to what you would look at if you're auditing shares or managed funds. But the problem is if it's new and it's unique and there's really no precedents to follow or guidelines to follow off, it can become a little bit difficult. But with cryptocurrency, what I would say is that the biggest problem that we see is that the trustees, the super fund, haven't set up their own cryptocurrency portfolio. Mum and dad have some cryptocurrency in their own name. They bought some Bitcoin and Ethereum because that's what everyone else was doing. And then they use that same account and their super fund bought some cryptocurrency as well. And so then now you're mingling personal and super fund assets, which is a no-go. The super fund needs to have a standalone policy.
Separation of assets, right?
Correct. It needs to have a standalone policy in the fund's name, and you need to be able to provide reportable documents that we can rely upon. We need to see what the fund holds at 30 June. We need the purchase contracts to show when you bought the cryptocurrency and for how much. And if you are receiving any income from these cryptocurrencies, whether it be from mining or disposals or whatever it might be, have that documentation ready. And if the platform that you are on can't provide that documentation, well, maybe you need to revise where you're holding your cryptocurrency, because those questions are going to get asked if your super fund is involved.
Mm-hmm.
Use those platforms outside of super, but for your super fund, you need those documents. And so I would just say, just do your research, make sure it's a viable platform that can provide you those documents to really make the audit and your accountant's job easier. Because you, even yourself, mate, you would need those documents just to be able to produce a set of accounts.
Yeah, it's tricky. And we have a situation recently where a client held some cryptocurrency in cold storage. And that was just an added layer of complexity where you don't have those reports or they're not as easily obtained, yep. I guess, and proof of ownership and issues like that. It's definitely a minefield. I would hope that as the cryptocurrency becomes more popular and held more widely across, retail investors, that the systems, I guess, and the software will catch up and there'll be, the equivalent of, the reporting standards of things like ComSec or NabTrade.
Yes.
That they will come across into the crypto field, because there are obviously providers out there who they have, the brokerage software for cryptocurrency. But from what I've seen, at least, the reporting standards aren't there with the ASX listed shares.
Yes. Couldn't agree more.
Right. Anything else? I know a classic one we come across is a client accidentally makes a transfer out of, say, they don't have access to the superannuation, they're 40 years old, they accidentally make a transfer, they're meant to pay a bill from their personal bank account, but they've accidentally paid it from the super fund bank account. Is there anything you can do to help, or to, not to help, but to any advice you give to clients to be able to avoid those, you know, silly mistakes that they just cause headaches for both the auditors and the accountant?
I would say that if you, the first thing is that if you've made a mistake in terms of paying money out of the fund or paying money back in, the general rule of thumb, if you are trying to alleviate any type of breach or reporting framework, would be try to rectify it within 30 days. There are some provisions that can allow essentially a contribution not to be accepted if it's within 30 days, or a payment to be considered a mistake if it's within a certain time frame. So I would say as soon as you've realized you've made a mistake, fix it up. Now, if it's a mistake that you've made and you've only realized when your accountant, you know, 8 months later when your accountant is doing the financials, well, you've got a little bit more of a problem then. And what will happen is it will be very dependent on the amount that has been withdrawn or deposited as to whether we've got a problem or not. Because what you deem a problem and what I deem a problem are two different things.
So does that where the 5% or $30,000 thresholds come back into play?
Yeah, that's right. So the thresholds that would be used for us, so if it's a first year fund, then the threshold actually drops down to $2,000. So if it's first year fund, if it's over $2,000, it needs to be reported.
As in first year you're auditing the fund, or first year the funds
existed? First year the funds existed. Yep. So I think it's actually 15 months. So for the first 15 months, that threshold becomes $2,000. But once we get over that 15-month timeframe, then our $30,000 or 5% mark guidelines are used. And so if, let's say, the amount is $500, you know, paid the electricity bill out of the super fund, well, then that, in theory, if it was the first year that we're auditing it, would just be a management letter, a notice to the trustees, hey, you've got this loan essentially, this financial assistance that you've provided yourself. Can you please rectify that before next year's audit? And as trustees, pay the money back into the fund, and hopefully that's the end of it. So just being aware of things, you know, I think that can probably be the biggest takeaway point. And actually calling your accountant regularly, if you've made a mistake, hey, don't hide things. We're all a team here. We're all trying to, you know, go towards the same goal. Let's just work out a plan, because what might happen sometimes is the accounting firm will call us and say, hey, what are the rules say? If you're not sure, call your auditor, ask them questions. You know, we know the rules. We'll tell you the rules, tell you the answers, and then hopefully that gives you enough information to help the trustees make an informed decision. Maybe where you're past the point where you can fix it and, you know, you might have a reportable contravention, that's okay. Let's work out if we need to put a loan agreement in place. Do we need to pay interest back? Like, what can we do to just reduce the risk from the ATO's standpoint? So I think just going through that process and being open, yep, I think that's probably the best policy.
And proactive as well. I think we talked about it a little bit before, but I feel the biggest thing I see is that the super fund ticks along for the entire year. Mistakes may be made. The trustees collate all the information at, you know, in October, the following financial year, and say, oh, we'll just sort it out when we do the return and financials, then we'll fix it at that point. But really, it needs to be something that's monitored throughout the course of the year. If mistakes are made during the year, that's, like you said, it can be fine. Just let the accountant know. They can discuss with the auditors at that point in time. We don't have to wait until the audit happens, you know, 6 months, 8 months later. These things can be addressed, and like you said, there's thresholds and time frames, which means that it may alleviate the audit consequences.
That's exactly right.
Right. How do you think the audit landscape's changed over the last few years? I think a big one that I've seen is in relation to property valuations. The auditors and the ATO tend to be placing more scrutiny on property valuations. Can you just elaborate on, I guess, what you've seen on your end? If that's true, I may be wrong.
Okay, so what I would say is that with most things, the rules, the people in the industry, I think everything's just developing very quickly. So what the information that we had available to us 5-10 years ago is a lot different to what we have now. There's more resources, there's more knowledge, there's greater time doing the same thing over and over. So I think you've just got a more educated industry now that can actually do a more thorough and more detailed analysis when auditing a fund. I think that's the biggest thing. With everything in life, time usually helps develop things. Football teams, sporting clubs, businesses, audits, SMSF, like time is a big thing. But with regards to property, the key elements when it comes to whether a property valuation is acceptable or not, the rules have really never changed. The rules state that you need objective and supportive data to determine the value of an asset. That's any asset in a super fund. So let's compare a listed security to a property. The reason why listed securities are valued every year without fail is because there's a platform that gives us the value every second. So if to find a valuation at 30 June, it's easy. Now, when it comes to property, there was this mythical three-year rule that a lot of people used to use and that was...
Including myself.
Yep. And I think the reason was that the argument was, well, property doesn't change in value as much. We can use that valuation more and more. And so what happened was that that rule became more widely accepted among firms and auditors, and the actual rules, the legislation, the guidelines almost got forgotten. And
like you said, had never changed.
That's right. And you know, and so what happened was a few years ago, the ATO reminded auditors and reminded the industry of what the rules were. Hey, everyone, here are the rules that you need to follow for valuations, objective and supportive data. So if you've got an appraisal, make sure it's got comparable sales on it. If you've got a valuation and we're auditing a 24-year fund and the valuation's for the 23-year, well, you need data to show that that valuation is still accurate. So that's the biggest change. So now what is happening is that a valuation, let's use our 23-24 example. Mm-hmm. If you've got a valuation for the 23-year, but we're audited in the 24-year, you're going to have to provide data to show that that's still accurate. And so that becomes very difficult to do, and thus, okay, it's probably just easier to get a valuation each year.
Yeah.
The rules don't say you need a valuation each year. You just need to prove the market value each year with your objective and supportive data.
So can you provide some examples of, because that is probably the biggest sticking point we have every year. We have the majority of our super fund clients, they have property,
yep.
A lot of commercial property. Now, obviously, with residential property, the valuation each year is much easier because there's online, we're talking about the capability of online systems, there's online software such as CoreLogic, RP Data, that are able to spit out valuations each year at, you know, I think it costs $30 or something like that. Residential property is far easier to deal with, in my opinion. The real sticking point we have with clients is the commercial valuations.
Yes.
Because like in the example you gave, they paid $1,500 in the 2023 year to get a commercial property valuation, and then they're being told in the 24 year that's no longer relevant, whether that's true or not. That's what they
yep.
believe. And we need to then pay another $1,500 to get another property valuation. Can you provide maybe some other metrics that can be used other than a formal valuation that your auditors will accept?
So when looking at a valuation, like we mentioned, I'll say it again, objective and supportive data. So back, if we just look at a valuation, whether it's from an agent, a registered valuer, or anyone in between, the valuation that is used needs to contain data to support how that underlying valuation was used. So in theory, you could go to your real estate agent and say, hey, agent, can you please provide an indicative valuation for this property? And so what the agent will have to do is they will have to say, okay, this commercial factory is worth $1 million and it's based, the $1 million valuation is based on these three factories that sold in the area on a very similar date of 1 million, 1.1 and 900,000. So that's how I've got my million. Perfect. Now, that's a more inexpensive option than seeing the registered valuer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the rules don't say that the valuation needs to be the most expensive, accurate valuation each year. It just needs to be based on objective and supportive data. So any valuation that is cost effective is just as reliable from an independent audit standpoint as the expensive registered value. Obviously, the registered one is going to be far more accurate, far more comprehensive, and it's going to provide other benefits. It might help determine the rental appraisal amount or whatever it might be, but any valuation can be used. There are online providers that do provide valuations on commercial property, and there's now even a online registered valuation service that's becoming pretty popular. I think, here's a little plug, nothing to do with them, but I think they're called True Market or True Property. And essentially what their service is you essentially go to the relevant property as a trustee, you take photos, you do a video, get some data for the property, and then you upload it to this online portal. And then they give you their valuation. They base the valuation on the information you've provided, the photos, the videos, the data that they have available to them, and they provide that valuation. And the valuations for commercial property start at $250-odd.
Bargain.
It's a bargain. And yes, okay, no one wants to pay that each year, but it's a starting point. And then what you could also do if you want to, if you've got this very comprehensive valuation, there are secondary sources that you can use in combination with one another. So for example, comparative sales is one. You might find some comparative sales in the area to show what the property prices were sold at recently and compare that to your last valuation, and then bang, you've got a secondary source. You might get the rates notice from 1 year to the next and determine whether there's been a difference in that value. And then that could be another source to say, hey, the rates notice has not changed over the last 2 years. This valuation then can still be used.
Yeah.
If the property's leased to an unrelated party, the rental yield that is being produced, in other words, the income divided by the property value is your yield. If that hasn't changed over the 2 year period, so let's say it's a 7% yield. If it's 7% in 2023 and 7% in 2024, again, there's another source. So that 23 valuation could be used if some of those other items were, I guess, obtained for the 24 year. But if you just have the 23 valuation and say, hey, I think this is good to go for 24, that's where you're going to run into some problems.
Right. And I guess a big talking point at the moment is the Division 296 proposal. Obviously, a big factor of how that is calculated is the market valuation of the fund. Do you see that once that tax is, you know, legislated in place, that will cause increased scrutiny over market valuations of assets, or is it the same situation of the rules have always been the case and therefore the standard of evidence will be the same?
I think if you look at the Div 296 regime, this is going to be a tax similar to the Division 293, where it's automatically assessed by the ATO and issued to the trustees. So it's something that will just be, I guess, completed in the background by the ATO. But when it comes to the actual SMSF audit themselves itself, and particularly in property or assets, I think where you've got, let's say, a range of evaluation that could be used, I think that range now will become quite useful to use. Typically, when you've got a range for property valuation, let's use that $1 million factory, the range might be 900,000 to 1.1. So typically, the accountants, the industry as a whole, will just pick the middle number, the average. Now, I think what we will see is trustees using that range a little bit more wisely to their advantage. Maybe if it's before these rules come into play, the higher end might get used. If we're later down the track where these rules are now in play, maybe the lower value gets used. If it's in the range and you're not breaking any rules and you've got that data to support that valuation, I think it's in arguably fair game.
Mm. Yeah, it'd be very interesting to see how it plays out, because you're right, some of the ranges that can be provided can be quite large, which is a problem in and of itself. I know, for example, we've had situations where we've used the online assessors to provide valuations for residential properties, but the valuation will come in at 800,000 to 1.3 mil, and the auditors have said that we can't use that valuation because the range is too big, which makes sense. How could you? You're pretty essentially doubling the value of the property.
I think though the key to remember is as an auditor, we are not here to audit the. This is where it gets difficult because as auditors, where the rules say objective and supportive data. So if there's a valuation that has a larger range, there's actually nothing in the rules that says that you can't use that. So I think that's sometimes where, as an auditor, you've got to be very careful with what you're instructing the trustees to do or to not do, or what you're saying they can or can't do. Because as an auditor, the rule that I have to follow is that I've got to use objective and supportive data. That's what you've got to use and provide to me. So if you've got that, well, then it becomes very difficult for me as an auditor to say you shouldn't use that.
Yeah.
Unless there's something obvious or evident or other information that I have on hand that tells me that that range is too big, or that tells me that this valuation's totally out of question. Mm-hmm. There are things that we can do to check the value of a property and use our own sources, but I think that's where sometimes the auditors might get a little bit carried away.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would just say be very weary of that, because I think there are rules, and it's very important that auditors are being proactive and trying to, you know, adjudicate things, but they've just got to, sometimes it's one of those things is look at what the rules are and maybe just follow those boundaries.
Right. So finally, is there one piece of advice that you could give to SMSF trustees to make the process less painful?
The last piece of advice I would give you is just be open to feedback. I think if you are aligned with a proactive firm like the Aintree Group, I think it's very important that you're very willing to accept and take on and improve from the feedback that your accountant gives you. If your accountant is telling you, hey, I've got these queries, or we've had the same queries each year, or you're too late in providing your info, I think you really need to cop that on the chin and use that information and improve. Because the most successful firms are the ones that are giving their trustees feedback, and the trustees are willing to accept the feedback. So
everyone's on the same team, right?
That's exactly right. Whereas if you've got the firm and the trustees where they're doing the same thing over and over, they're a hamster in a wheel, really not moving anywhere, I think you're going to run into the same problems each year, and you're actually not going to have a way to improve because you're actually not doing anything to improve. So align yourself with a firm that's proactive. Align yourself with a firm that really cares about your SMSF and your growth and being efficient and improving, and then let them guide you and just step you through the process. And I think if you can do that, I think you'll be in pretty good hands.
Awesome. That's great advice, Frank. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Plant Grow REIT podcast. A new episode will go live in 2 weeks. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll chat again soon.